You know, in 1929, Winston Churchill lost his seat in the Commons, and there was a Conservative defeat in 1929. And the next 10 years, he classed as his wilderness years, the years from 1929 to 1939. For 10 whole years, he was not in public office, as far as I'm aware. He had certain public functions that he fulfilled as part of the Conservative Party, but he actually wasn't elected as a member of Parliament and certainly wasn't in the cabinet at all. And yet, you know, there are some that say that, those 10 years, those wilderness years that he had, were the most productive of his entire life. Now you say, well, how on earth can you get wilderness years being so productive? Well, basically, he was the lone voice against Hitler at that time. And he was warning what was happening over in Germany and what was happening on the continent. He could see what was taking place. And the question has got to be, why could he see what was taking place, whereas everybody around him was desperately trying to placate Germany, trying to work with Germany, trying to go alongside of Germany? And quite frankly, even Mr. Churchill went ahead and had a certain admiration for Hitler and had an admiration for him being patriotic and supporting his country. He didn't have any qualms with that. But he was warning what was taking place over in Europe and what was happening and the rearming of Germany and all the various things were taking place. And he was a lone voice giving warning to the British public and also to the politicians, who were totally ignoring him and sidelining him. And the question is, why? Well, a great deal of that is because during those wilderness years, he was writing a book. In fact, it was a bit more than a book. It was 4 volumes, huge volumes of a work. It was over 1 million words altogether. It took him 10 years to actually research and write. And you think, well, okay, what kind of book could he be writing at that time? Well, he also wrote the History of the English-Speaking Peoples at that time as well. But the book he was writing was Marlborough, His Life and Times. And you think, well, what's that got to do with the price of putty? And but Marlborough was an interesting individual. His name was Churchill. He was actually an ancestor of Winston Churchill. It was John Churchill, who was the first Duke of Marlborough. And he was born in about 1650. Well, not about, he was born in 1650. And when you think about what was going on there, and you think, well, how can this possibly help Churchill recognize what was going on in Europe? Well, what was happening at that time? You have this Bible, which I've got, this new Bible here is the King James Bible. And the James the First, the Bible was 1611. And then you've got Charles the First, who got his head chopped off about a year or so before John Churchill was born. And so when John Churchill was born, he was born into Cromwell country. Cromwell had the control at that time, and the Parliament was holding sway for about best part of 10 years. And being born in 1650, and his father, who was actually, this is John Churchill now, back in 1650, his father was another Winston Churchill, another guy called Winston Churchill. And he unfortunately had backed the wrong side. He'd backed the Cavaliers against the Roundheads. And as a result of that, he was fined 400 and something pounds. Now, 400 and something pounds was a fantastic amount of money, a phenomenal amount of money at that time. And the family was in, not penury, but he was certainly struggling. And this was the background of John Churchill as the first Duke of Marlborough. And you think, well, how did that actually, how did he become the Duke? What happened to him? And, you know, why is this so interesting to Winston Churchill? Why would he spend 10 years of his life researching and writing about Marlborough, the life and times? And I want to stress that it's not just his life, it's the times as well. And the times are very, very important as to what was actually taking place at that time. Because after Cromwell, you get to 1660, and John Churchill would be about 10 years old at that time. Charles II came back and actually became the new king. And so You've got Charles II, and I think that Churchill actually came into the court of Charles II. And then there was James II in 1685. Now, James II was a Catholic, and therefore he was actually deposed by William of Orange. The William of Orange, the Orange men over in Northern Ireland and all the troubles that they had in Ireland, that's the same William Orange. He came over from Holland, and he married Mary. And you got William and Mary. You get William and Mary of furniture and this kind of thing today. But Mary was, in fact, I believe, the daughter of James II. And so that was about 1689 through to about the 1700. And then came Queen Anne, which was the sister of Mary. So it's all this time was what was going on as far as John Churchill was concerned, the first Duke born in 1650. So by the time we get to 1700, he was 50 years old. Now, Winston Churchill was born in Blenheim Palace. And Blenheim Palace, to this day, you can still go around Blenheim, and it's quite an interesting place to visit. And around Blenheim Palace, and in its thousands of acres of surrounding parkland, that you find it. It's a place just north of Oxford, and just outside of London, in the northern part of London. And Winston Churchill was born in Blenheim Palace, and you ask the question, well, why Blenheim? Why is it called Blenheim Palace? Well, the reason for that goes back to this time in 1650. And you're looking at Marlborough, his life and times, what was going on actually at that time. And that what was going on was an individual called Louis XIV in France. And Louis XIV was a warmonger. He was bringing war to the nations of Europe. And it was, in fact, John Churchill who, during the reign of Queen Anne, around 1700, who went ahead and blocked him. His first decisive real battle was at Blenheim on the Danube. And what he actually did, I think I've got time. I'll probably go into two sermons anyway. So, but what he actually did, he was in Holland and he was besieging a town in Holland. And again, with a strong army in there. And he heard of this other army from Louis XIV, over in Germany, in Bavaria, which is right down towards Austria, down towards Switzerland and northern Italy and that kind of area. So he started to make his way away from Holland, from the town he was surrounding, and he started to go down the Rhine, which it discharges in Holland, and goes all the way, the Rhine runs all the way up to the mountains, the mountains in Switzerland, in Austria, quite frankly. And so he started to move all his armies, several hundred men, or several thousand men, sorry, and moving down the Rhine. But as he did so, he took barges with him so that he could at any time jump in, the entire army could get into these barges and float down the Rhine, going downstream. So it took him weeks to march all the way up through to the Danube, but at any stage he could have jumped into the barges and been back at this place that he was besieging within days, within 2 or 3 days, as he came down, he actually progressed up that that part of the Rhine. And he finally ended up at this place called Blenheim, which is on the Danube in Bavaria. And it was a decisive battle, and that's the reason why you got Blenheim, which is the English equivalent of Blenheim, as the name for Blenheim Palace, which is where Winston Churchill was born, where he grew up, and as I say, it's still there today. You can still go down just north of Oxford and see Blenheim Palace. And it was Marlborough. This was the Duke of Marlborough. This was John Churchill, the first Duke of Marlborough. And he was the one that then was given, actually, he was given £1 million by the state for the service to the state of defeating Louis XIV of France. Because, quite frankly, were it not for that one, but the battles that this man fought, and the victories that he won, France would have been the dominant power, not Britain. It was literally that crucial. And so when we're looking at Marlborough, his life and times, it's what was actually going on in Germany, in France, in Europe generally, in the 1600s that led up to this battle, led up to the rise of the first Duke of Marlborough. And when you're looking at this, Winston Churchill would go across to Germany, to Blenheim, to actually do his research during these wilderness years. And during these wilderness years, as he went and researched his ancestors, he was researching what not just his ancestors, but he's researching the times in which his ancestors were living. And he therefore was looking at the structure of this individual, Louis XIV, and the way in which he rose to prominence, and the way in which he was a warmonger, the way in which he manipulated the spirit of the age that produced the problem that actually came about, that his ancestor had to therefore rectify in Britain's interests. And when he was doing this research, when he was in Bavaria, in fact, he even had an arrangement to visit with Hitler. Hitler was due to actually come and visit Winston Churchill in Bavaria when he was there doing some of the research for this book. And Hitler didn't make the appointment. And it was found out later that he looked upon Winston Churchill as a has-been, as somebody who... He was, quite frankly, you know, he was once in Parliament, he was once in the Cabinet, but, you know, he's a has-been. He's a past spent force, never to resurface again, and therefore didn't take any notice of him. If only he knew, you know. But he was actually researching this subject about Louis XIV, and the parallels with Hitler were huge. So what he was doing with the research, what he was actually researching for his book, as he was looking at the situation going on in 1600s and leading up to 1700, he was seeing the exact same thing happening at that time in Germany with Hitler, with the Nazi Party, and everything else that was taking place. So he could. This is why some have actually said that what the wilderness years from 1929 to 1939 were in fact the most productive. Because it laid the bedrock from which he made the analysis that he made, and therefore became that lone voice against Hitler, against what was going on in Germany, because it was based on this background that he had, which nobody else had. Nobody else really understood, nobody else really saw. And when you consider that when he finally, I mean, Hitler invaded Poland, Chamberlain declared war. He said basically we're at war with Germany because he drawn the line in the sand because of the treaty that he had with Poland, or Britain had with Poland. And that was 1939. And Winston Churchill was then brought back as First Lord of the Admiralty, and he became part of the cabinet again. But it wasn't until 1940, and 10th of May 1940, aged 65, that he became Prime Minister at the resignation of Chamberlain, because Chamberlain could see that he didn't have what it really took to lead the country through the kind of trial that it was having to go through. And it was having to go through the kind of trial it was going through because the people disregarded and did not take any notice of what, in fact, Churchill had said. And they disregarded it because they did not know the background. Now, it's interesting that when you look at this, and again, this is important because it was God who was actually placing Churchill in the position that he found himself. And it was God who steered the Allies to victory, ultimately. But he used individuals to do it. And he used Churchill, and he therefore allowed this wilderness years. He allowed the wilderness years. He presumably... whether he engineered the actual subject matter of the book, I have no idea. God himself knows how, in fact, it materialized. But he certainly had his hand in the process. And it's also interesting that another person arose at that same time, which was Roosevelt in the United States. Now, Mr. Roosevelt was a history major in Harvard. And he, therefore, the first thing that Churchill did was, as each volume became published, he shipped it across to Roosevelt to read. And and Roosevelt was very interested in it. And he could see, without any problem at all, the same problems that Churchill also could see. So the two sides of the Atlantic, you had people who were able to see what was taking place. And as I say, on the 10th of May 1940, aged 65, he writes, he says, "I was conscious of a profound sense of relief. At last I had authority to give directions over the whole scene, and I felt as if I was walking with destiny, and that all my past life had been but a preparation for this hour and for this trial." Now, his past life included the wilderness years. It includes the wilderness years. And as I said, if it wasn't for that book that he was researching, would he have had the kind of comprehension of what was going on? Would he have been able to really see what had been going on without the wilderness years and the events that took place at that time? It's very, very doubtful whether he would. But he said, "I slept soundly and had no need for cheering dreams. Facts are better than dreams." But as I say, God was using Churchill, and he trained him during this particular time. And also, God is training us. Because, quite frankly, what I want to do today is I want to look at how God uses wilderness years to train those that he works with. The word wilderness does not necessarily mean useless. It's very much the case that in Churchill's case, it was crucial to his understanding, his grasp of the situation and what was rising in Europe. His research that he was doing led to his assessment. And so what I want to do today is look at how God uses the wilderness years to train those he works with. As right now, quite frankly, that's what we are in. We are in wilderness years. And we are being, whether we like it or not, whether we understand it or not, whether we realize what God is doing or not, we are being trained, we are being assessed. And it's only in hindsight that you then can see many times what in fact has taken place. But you know, like Churchill, what we'll probably find out is they turn out to be the most productive periods of our physical lives. But are they? Are they really our productive, most productive? Are we allowing God to give us the training that's necessary? And again, I mean, Churchill's life could have been snuffed out during those particular years. If you remember, he went over to America on a speaking engagement and a tour during these wilderness years, and he looked the wrong way in New York and stepped out in front of a taxi cab and had his leg broken. And if the taxi cab had been going a bit faster, that would have been the end of Churchill. So, you know, it could have worked out in a very, very different way. Very different way. But I thought it was interesting that when you go back and just see what he was doing during that time, that he was writing a book, Marlborough, and it wasn't just Marlborough his life. It was Marlborough his life and his times. And it's the times that they were living in, and it was the rise of Louis XIV, and the way Louis XIV, the atmosphere, the spirit behind Louis XIV, and his warmongering. He was called the Sun King. You know, everything revolved around him, and he was a big cheese. And Hitler was my Führer, you know, and everything revolved around him, and he was the big cheese. And he was doing exactly the same kind of thing as Louis XIV was doing. He was doing exactly the same kinds of things. The same spirit of the age was repeating itself. And both Winston Churchill and also Teddy Roosevelt could see this taking place. And they had to use their political nous to try and bring everybody else behind them. But let's say, it is very much what we're in today. And yet, like Churchill, we'll probably find they turn out to be the most productive period of our physical lives. And part of the way in which Churchill assessed this problem was to go back to his ancestors, to look at what was happening with John Churchill, to look at what the environment was like regarding John Churchill and how it was all slotting into place, and to learn the lessons of history. So what I want to do today is to learn the lessons of history, and I want to go through, first of all, talk about Abraham, because Abraham had wilderness years. He dwelled in tents. And secondly, you don't have to be in the wilderness, literally, to have a wilderness year. Joseph found himself in prison. Those were his wilderness years. And again, it was times that he learned. God wouldn't have allowed it without the lessons that were necessary for Joseph to have. Moses spent 40 years keeping sheep. So again, we need to go back and have a look at that and just remind ourselves what actually took place at that time. And Israel, the very word, wilderness years, it was coined by Winston Churchill, it came from the Bible. It came from the understanding of the wilderness years, the children of Israel wandering in the wilderness for 40 years. And so we can go back to then and again remind ourselves where it came from. David, fleeing from Saul, he had a series of wilderness years. Mr. Armstrong also had a series of wilderness years because he had 28 years of poverty. And finally, the church today, after the apostasy, the time we find ourselves in today, also is very much that way. So, and I don't lessen the fact that Churchill, I feel God's hand was with Churchill. He was training Churchill. He was going to use Churchill in the future to save physical Israel. And so the wilderness years of Churchill are certainly not to be dismissed lightly. What in fact happened and took place then, it certainly can be used by us as we look at some the ones that went before us were scripturally and notice what in fact happened in their lives as well. Now, how far I'll get in this today, I'm not quite sure. But we'll see whether I'll get right the way through or whether we'll just get so far. But let's turn over to Genesis 15. Genesis chapter 15. And unlike the other Bible, these pages don't fall out. But they just take longer to turn. So in Genesis chapter 15, and we look, it says in verse 1, after these things, the word of the Eternal came to Abram in a vision, saying, Fear not, Abram, I am your shield and your exceeding great reward. And Abram said, Lord Eternal, what will you give me, seeing I go childless, and the steward of my house is Eliezer of Damascus? So there was a real problem that he had to face, that he was childless. He'd been given certain promises, but, you know, it says, And Abram said, Behold, to me you have given no seed, and lo, one born in my house is my heir. And behold, the word of the Eternal came to him, saying, This shall not be your heir, but he that comes forth out of your own bowels shall be your heir. And he brought him forth abroad, and he said, Look now towards heaven, tell the stars if you are able to number them. And he said to him, So shall your seed be. And he believed in the Eternal, and he counted it to him for righteousness. And he said unto him, and I want you to notice this, he said unto him, I am the Eternal that brought you out of Ur of the Chaldees to give you this land to inherit it. So he was the one that actually brought him out of Ur of the Chaldees. Notice, so the command to come forth was from Ur of the Chaldees. Now the Ur of the Chaldees is down the southern part of Iraq today. And if we turn back to Genesis 12, we found that it says, Now the Eternal had said to Abram, Get out of your country and from your kindred and from your father's house to a land that I will show you. So this command, and when he said the command come out of Ur of the Chaldees, we just read over in Genesis 15, 7. This command that we're reading here in verse 1 of chapter 12 was a command given to Abraham or Abram as he was at that time, and it was given in Ur of the Chaldees. It wasn't given in Haran, because it says, "And I'll make of you a great nation, and will bless you, and make your name great, and I'll bless them that bless you, and curse him that curses you, and in you shall all families of the earth be blessed." So Abram departed, as the Eternal had spoken to him, and Lot went with him, and Abram was 75 years old when he departed out of Haran. So he came from Haran at age 75. And you, to understand that, you read the end of the preceding chapter, where it says, "Now these," in verse 27, "these are the generations of Terah," which is the father of Abraham. "Terah begat Abram, Nahor, and Haran begat Lot. And Haran died before his father Terah in the land of the nativity in Ur of the Chaldees. And Abram and Nahor took them wives, and its name of Abraham's wife was Sarah, and the name of Nahor's wife was Milcah, a daughter of Haran, the father of Milcah, and the father of Iscah. But Sarai was barren, and she had no child. And Terah took Abram his son, and Lot his son of Haran, and his son's son, and Sarai his daughter-in-law, his son Abraham's wife. And he went forth with them from Ur of the Chaldees to go to the land of Canaan. And they came to Haran, and they dwelt there." Now Haran is still there to this day. It's actually, if you go to the border of Syria, and you go across the border of Syria into Turkey today, you'll come on the Euphrates River. You come to the place of Haran. So Haran is still there. And it says, "In the days of Terah were 205 years, and Terah died in Haran." So on the Euphrates, Mesopotamia area, you know, if you Tigris and Euphrates area, and Mesopotamia falls between the two big rivers. And so he went, in fact, they went to Haran. So they were in Ur of the Chaldees. Now, Ur of the Chaldees was a major, major metropolis at that time in the south. Now, there's some people say the Ur of the Chaldees, it wasn't really the Ur of the Chaldees at all. It was some little town somewhere up near the Black Sea. And therefore, it was in fact in Mesopotamia anyway, and they just kind of transferred across to Haran. But that doesn't make sense. In fact, what seems to have happened is that in Ur of the Chaldees, which is down in the southern area of Iraq, the word came to Abraham, or Abram as he was then, to get out and of Ur, and to then go to Canaan, to a place that he'd be shown, and in Canaan to therefore be made a great nation. And he was childless, and he believed God, and he therefore arranged with Terah his father and his brothers, and they all, and except for Haran himself, Haran, who gave the name to the place Haran, he died in Ur of the Chaldees. But Lot his son, and they all moved together as a family. But the trouble is that Abram was subject to his father Terah, and Terah made the decision to stay in Haran, and made the decision, right, we, you know, we're fed up with this moving, I'm sick of living in a tent, I'm going to stay here, in this place in the Mesopotamia. And so he stayed in Mesopotamia, and if you notice, let's see, if you go over to Genesis 24, verse 10, "And the servant took 10 camels of the camels of his master and departed, for all his goods of his master were in his hand." Now this was Abraham's servant going to find a wife for Isaac. And he arose and he went to Mesopotamia under the city of Nahor. The city of Nahor. Nahor, remember we just read about, Nahor stayed in Mesopotamia. He stayed in the area around Haran. So obviously he's got Haran is one place that they had a name, they named after the son that died. But Nahor was the actual son that remained. Now, so Nahor was left. So when we look here, when you see, let's go back again to Genesis 12. And when we say, so Abraham departed in verse 4, so Abram departed as the Eternal had spoken to him, and Lot went with him, and Abram was 75 years old when he departed out of Haran, but Nahor stayed behind. So not only had he had to travel from Ur of the Chaldees and leave the metropolis of Ur of the Chaldees, he then went into Mesopotamia, where Terah decided, no, we're going to stay here. And all that time, and they presumably built up a fair amount of wealth at that time, and by the trading that they had. And he was exceedingly rich when he left Ur of the Chaldees, when he left Haran. He was a wealthy man. In fact, I think it says, verse 5, and Abram took Sarah, his wife, and his brother's son, with all their substance that they'd gathered, and the souls that they'd gotten in Haran, and they went forth into the land of Canaan, the land of Canaan they came. So the trading that he'd done, the expertise that he'd been able to bring from Ur of the Chaldees into Haran, and they made a fantastic amount of money and a fantastic amount of wealth there, and Nahor stayed. He didn't want to move anywhere. He stayed in there. So this is why the servant went back to that area, because he knew that his family was of Nahor, was going to be in that area. But Abraham went on. Abraham went on, and if you notice, he was again childless. And if you notice over in Genesis 17, and in verse... And God said, verse 15, and God said to Abraham, as for Sarah your wife, you shall not call her name Sarai, but Sarah shall her name be. And I will bless her, and give her you a son of her. Yes, I will bless her, and she shall be a mother of nations. Kings of people shall be of her. Then Abraham fell upon his face, and laughed, and said in his heart, shall a child be born to him at 100 years old? And shall Sarah, that is 90 years old, bear? So here they are, the 90-year-old wife and a 100-year-old man, and God had said to them, you're going to have a child. And all that time, and from Ur of the Chaldees, what age was he? Was he 15 years? Did he spend 15 years in Haran? Probably, something like that. So it would have been, what, until the actual birth of the child, what is it, 40 years? Could easily have been 40 years, maybe even longer, that he had to wait. Now, if we go over to Hebrews chapter 11, which recounts this event, these were the wilderness years of Abraham. They were literally wandering around in the wilderness. Let's say he was a city dweller. He came from Ur of the Chaldees. It was probably one of the greatest metropolises in the entire known world at that time. He went to Haran with Terah, his father. He stayed in Haran and he made a fantastic amount of money. Nahor remained behind, but he still pushed on. He still went ahead and went on because he believed God, quite frankly. But here in Hebrews 11, verse 8, it says, by faith Abraham, when he was called to go out of a place where he should have to receive for an inheritance, obeyed, and he went out, not knowing where he went. By faith he sojourned in the land of promise, as in a strange country, dwelling in tabernacles with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. For he looked, notice, for he looked for a city which had foundations, whose builder and maker was God. These were the wilderness years. He was actually travelling, living in a tent, having been used to, obviously, a house, living in Ur of the Chaldees, which was a metropolis, and then Haran thereafter. And the reason he was doing that was he was looking for a city which has foundations, whose builder and maker was God. And it wasn't just the city that he was thinking of, physically in Jerusalem, say. It wasn't Jerusalem or Horeb or all these other areas that were in that particular location. It was ultimately the New Jerusalem, and he basically believed God, and to do that, he literally dwelt in tents. Let's turn back to let's turn over the page to Hebrews 12. Because talking of this particular incident and the others, it says, therefore, seeing that we also are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin that which does easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us. In other words, we look at the wilderness years that Abraham went through, and the deprivation that he had, the fact that he had to live in a tent, it says earlier on in Hebrews 11, by faith he sojourned in the land of promise, in a strange country, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise, because he went ahead and he was looking for a city. He was believing God. And we are surrounded by witnesses like that. We're running with patience the race that is set before us. So if we find ourselves in a wilderness situation, we behave in the same way. We get our eyes focused on the future that God has put in front of us. And again, realize that the wilderness years that we have are not years that are defunct. They're anything but. It's the same as Churchill. Churchill's wilderness years were not defunct years. They enabled him to make an accurate assessment of what he was seeing within Europe, because he was able to base it on what he was researching of his ancestor back in 1650. And he was able to see the parallels, and the huge parallels that are there, and gave him a statesmanship position which nobody else in the country had. Absolutely nobody else had at all. And it's, again, we have been given a privileged position. We've been given a privileged perspective on the world that we see today. And we've got to make sure that we understand it in the light of the wilderness years that our ancestors have gone ahead and have lived through, such as Abraham. Turn over to Romans chapter 4. Romans chapter 4. But in Romans 4, let's pick it up in verse 17. It says, as it's written, I have made you a father of many nations. So he had the promise from God, but nothing had happened. Before him who he believed, even God who quickens the dead and calls those things which are not as though they were. He understood that this is the Creator God they were dealing with. This is not just some God of the nations round about. This is the God, the one true creating God, who against hope believed in hope. In other words, it was against all evidence that was there. Against hope, he believed in hope that he may become the father of many nations according to that which was spoken by God, spoken by Christ, and given to Abraham. So shall your seed be. And being not weak in faith, he considered not his own body now dead, when he was about 100 years old, now the deadness of Sarah's womb, and Sarah was 90. And it's impossible, totally impossible. How many other people do you know who have had a child aged 100 with a wife of 90? There's no one. I mean, even with fertility treatments, you wouldn't get it, quite frankly. He staggered not at the promise of God through unbelief, but was strong in faith, giving glory to God. When he laughed, it was this is wonderful, this is marvelous. It wasn't something which was, he didn't laugh the way Sarah laughed. Sarah laughed and saying, oh, I'd like to see that happen. But that's not the way he laughed. And being fully persuaded that what he had promised he was able to perform, and therefore it was imputed to him for righteousness. Now it was not written for his sake alone that it was imputed to him, but for us also, so that we in our wilderness years can look back on his wilderness years and see the same and act in the same way, just the same as Churchill was able to look back on his ancestors' wilderness years and see the parallels with the time that he was living in. The same thing applies as far as we are concerned also. but for us also, to whom it should be imputed, if we believe on him that raised up Jesus our Lord from the dead, who was delivered for our offences and was raised again for our our complete justification, complete preparation for the is raised so that we can obtain salvation. Let's turn over to final scripture in this section about Abraham. Turn over to Isaiah 51, which we have, and Isaiah 51 we have on our website, and with good reason as well, it's on there. In Isaiah 51, remember the position that Abraham is going to hold. As far as we can tell, he will be number two underneath Christ in the world tomorrow. I say number two, I mean number three, obviously underneath the Father, but he'll be right underneath Christ. He'll be working with Christ as the Father of the faithful. But listen to me, notice in chapter 51, verse 1, listen to me, you that follow after righteousness. Those of us that are also having to go perhaps through wilderness years, having to suffer the same kind of things. You that seek the eternal, look to the rock of which you are hewn, and the hole of the pit from where you are dug. In other words, you go back to your ancestors. You look at what actually happened in these particular cases. And the one ancestor we go back to, it says, look to Abraham your father, and to Sarah that bore you. For I called him alone and blessed him and increased him. For the Eternal shall comfort Zion. He will comfort all her waste places. And he will make her wilderness like Eden and her desert like the garden of the Eternal. Joy and gladness shall be found therein, thanksgiving and the voice of melody. Listen to me, my people, and give ear to me, my nation. For a law shall proceed from me, and I will make my judgment to rest for a light to the people. We're going to have a place within that. And again, he says, look to Abraham your father, look to Sarah, the one that bore you, and understand that these individuals, as our ancestors, our spiritual ancestors, are the ones, in fact, that we can go back to and learn lessons from as we go through our own wilderness years ourselves, just in the same way as Churchill learned the lessons that he did. By going back to his ancestor, which was the first Duke of Marlborough, and seeing what in fact took place at that time. Okay, let's go back to Genesis again, which is the reason why I have this Bible. Genesis 37. Now in Genesis 37 we find that Jacob dwelt in the land where his father was a stranger, in the land of Canaan. And these are the generations of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brethren. So we're looking at Joseph now at 17. So he was just he might have turned 18, who knows, by the time he was sold into slavery. But he wouldn't have been much older than that. He was probably still 17. He's probably still 17. Feeding his flock with his brethren. And the lad was with the sons of Bilhah, with the sons of Zilpha, his father's wives, and Joseph brought unto his father their evil report. Now Israel loved Joseph more than all the children, because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a coat of many colours. Now, there's been speculation whether in fact it was a tartan, for the tribe, but whether in fact it is or not, I have no idea. But the coat of many colours could well have been something to do with heredity, and that kind of thing, but that is speculative to a large degree. And notice in verse 5, and it says, and Joseph dreamed a dream, and he told it to his brethren, and they hated him yet the more. And he said to them, hear, I pray you, this dream that I've dreamed. For behold, we were binding sheaves in the field, and lo, my sheaf arose, and also stood upright, and behold, your sheaves stood round about, and made obeisance to my sheaf. And his brethren said to him, shall you indeed reign over us? Or shall you indeed have dominion over us? And they hated him yet the more for his dreams and for his words. And he dreamed yet another dream, and told it to his brethren. And he said, behold, I've dreamed a dream again. And behold, the sun and the moon and the 11 stars made obeisance to me. And he told it to his father and to his brethren. And his father rebuked him and said to him, "What is this dream that you dreamed? Shall I and my mother, your mother and your brethren indeed come to bow ourselves down towards the earth?" His brethren envied him, but his father observed that saying. So we see that at age 17, God was working with him. How could Joseph go ahead and dream a dream like that unless God inspired that dream? Unless God was actually working with him? And God knew that, God had actually said to Abraham, so Genesis 15, it says in verse 13, it says, "And he said to Abraham, know for a surety that your seed shall be a stranger in a land that is not theirs, and shall serve them, and they shall afflict them 400 years, and also that nation that they shall serve will I judge, and afterwards shall they come out with great substance." So God could see, the one that became Jesus Christ could see down into the future. And Joseph here, when you go back to Genesis 37, Joseph, I can turn back to Genesis 37. Although Joseph was 17, he was fitting within God's plan, and God was giving him the dreams as to what was in fact going to take place. Now he had some real lessons to learn. I mean, lessons of tact might be one of them, rather than going and blabbing about his dreams to his brothers and his mother and father. His father, actually, because his mother had died. It was something that was about to happen. It was something that was given to him by God himself. Now, let's turn over to Genesis 40. Genesis 40. And in verse 14, it says, well, having given it to the cupbearer, to the butler, "And yet within 3 days shall Pharaoh lift up your head and restore into your place, and you shall deliver Pharaoh's cup to his hand," when he was butler. But in verse 14 it says, "But think on me when it shall be well with you, and show kindness, I pray you, unto me, and make mention of me to Pharaoh, and bring me out of this house." Now, he was forgotten in prison. He was in there for a false charge. These were very much his wilderness years. And again, age 17, what was he, 18, 19, 20, when Potiphar's wife go ahead and surreptitiously got him put into prison. But over in verse 20, "And it came to pass on the third day, which was Pharaoh's birthday, that he made a feast unto all his servants, and he lifted up the head of the chief butler and of the chief baker amongst his servants, and he restored the chief butler to his butlership again, and he gave the cup to Pharaoh's hand. But he hanged the chief baker, as Joseph had interpreted to them. Yet did not the chief butler remember Joseph, but he forgot him." So, again, he was completely and totally forgotten, as far as he could tell. And yet was he? I mean, was that the case? Was that the reality of the case? If we go back and we look at it, I mean, we look at the news today. The news today out of Germany, out of Europe, out of the Middle East, out of Israel, out of Nigeria, out of across the world, out of Ukraine, out of Russia, out of Britain, America, and the fiat currency. You know, there's so many things that are actually taking place, yet it hasn't happened yet. It hasn't happened yet. And have we been forgotten of the things that we understood before? Are they ever going to take place? We can get like that. We can start thinking, you know, is it really going to happen? Well, it is going to happen. It will take place. And we are in wilderness years. And here is Joseph, who had been in prison for some considerable time. As I say, he was 17. It would probably be the best part of 10 years, I would have thought, he'd been in prison. Say 8 years by that time, and another 2 years beyond there. And it says in chapter 41, it says, "And it came to pass at the end of 2 full years that Pharaoh dreamed, and behold, he stood by the river." So 2 full years more went by before And if you notice in chapter 41, which is where we were reading, if you notice in verse 46, it says, "And Joseph was 30 years old when he stood before Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And Joseph went out from the presence of Pharaoh and went throughout all the land of Egypt." So, age 30. So he was 17 when it started, when the dreams began. And it was very shortly after that that he would have been sold into slavery. Maybe 18. Doubt if it was 19, but he was certainly that kind of order, probably 17 still. And yet he found himself on a trumped-up charge, put into prison. And it wasn't just basically put into prison. Turn over to Psalm 105 and just remind yourself of this also. In Psalm 105. Psalm 105, we'll pick it up in verse 8, and it says, "And he has remembered his covenant forever, the word which he commanded to 1,000 generations, which covenant he made with Abraham, and his oath unto Isaac, and confirmed the same to Jacob for a law, and to Israel for an everlasting covenant." This was the reason why Joseph was in prison. This is the reason why Joseph was in Egypt. And part of the lessons that he had to learn, he had to learn within these wilderness years when he was actually in prison. "Saying, unto you will I give this land of Canaan, the lot of your inheritance, when there were but a few men in number, yes, very few, and strangers in it. And when they went from one nation to another, from one kingdom to another people, he allowed no man to do them wrong, yes, he reproved the kings for their sake, saying, touch not my anointed and my prophets no harm. Moreover, he called for a famine upon the land. He broke the whole staff of bread. He sent a man before them, even Joseph, who was sold for a servant, for a slave, whose feet, notice, they hurt with fetters. He was laid in iron. Until, notice, until the time that his word came, the word of the Eternal tested him." The word of the Eternal tested him. And that was the reason for him being in prison. That was the reason for his wilderness years. It was the testing that was taking place. Now we are in the same boat. We are being tested. We are being tried. We are in a wilderness period. We need to go back to our ancestors, our spiritual ancestors, and notice what actually took place, and realize that these individuals also went ahead and were tested and were tried during the wilderness years, because God had a bigger purpose, had a bigger view of life, and was able to actually orchestrate things that no human being could. "The king sent and loosed him, even the ruler of the people, and let him go free. He made him lord of his house and ruler of all his substance, to bind his princes at his pleasure, and to teach his senators wisdom." So here was an individual in the dungeon with his feet hurt in fetters, and quite frankly, there's some speculation that he was actually crippled, made lame. I mean, can you imagine if this was the case? It happened to you, would you feel God had deserted you? Would we feel that? Well, the chances are we would. We've never suffered anything like that. And yet we can get so bogged down with our problems and difficulties and lose sight of the one that, who's actually dealing with us, who's actually working with us. And turn over to Genesis, back to Genesis again, Genesis 45. And realize that this, after having gone through the problems he did, back in Genesis 45, it says, "And Joseph said to his brethren," verse 4, "Joseph said to his brethren, come near to me, I pray you. And they came near, and he said, I am Joseph, your brother, who you sold into Egypt." Yeah, I tell you, what a bombshell that would have been. It went down like a lead balloon, obviously, but notice what he said. He said, "Now therefore do not be grieved nor angry with yourselves that you sold me here, for God did send me before you to preserve life." He could then see the position that he held. He could then see the reason for his, he could see his own arrogancy, his own lack of tact, his the reason why he got up his brother's nose. The way he did. He could see that because he'd gone through the wilderness years himself. He'd gone through the problems that he'd faced. For these 2 years has the famine been in the land, and yet there are 5 years in which there shall be neither earing nor harvest. And God sent me before you to preserve you a posterity in the earth, and to save your lives by a great deliverance. He recognized his position. And, Churchill said, I felt as if I was walking with destiny, and that all my past life had been but a preparation for this hour, and for this trial. So he could see his life in a perspective, and without the wilderness years, without having written the book on his ancestors, the first Duke of Marlborough, he wouldn't have had that same kind of perspective. He wouldn't have had the depth of perspective that he actually was able to exert. Now, if we go back to Isaiah again, Isaiah 51, which is where we have been before. We've been reading about how, looking to Abraham, your father, and to Sarah that bare you, for I called him alone and blessed him and increased him. In other words, go back and look at that example there. But these individuals that he's writing to here in Isaiah, it says in verse 7, it says, "Listen to me, you that know righteousness, the people in whose heart is my law. Do not fear the reproach of men, neither be afraid of their revilings. For the moth shall eat them up like a garment, the worm shall eat them like wool. But my righteousness shall be forever, and my salvation from generation to generation." And these have been preserved for us. So that when we go through wilderness years, we can read these examples that are being given here. And in fact, it's prophetic to a large degree. "Awake and put on strength, O arm of the Eternal. Awake as in ancient days, in the generations of old. Are you not it that has cut Rahab and wounded the dragon? Are you not it that has dried the sea, the waters of the great deep, that made the depths of the sea a way for the ransom to pass over? Therefore the redeemed of the Eternal shall return and come with singing to Zion. An everlasting joy shall be upon their heads, and they'll obtain gladness and joy, and sorrow and mourning shall flee away." And that is what we're looking forward to. That's the focus point. That's what Joseph had to, keep his mind focused on as he faced his wilderness years in a dungeon. "I, even I, am he that comforts you. Who are you that you should be afraid of a man that should die, and of the Son of Man which shall be made as grass? And you forget the Eternal your Maker, that has stretched forth the heavens and laid the foundations of the earth, and have feared continually every day because of the fury of the oppressor, as if he were ready to destroy. And where is the fury of the oppressor?" At the end of the game, end of the day, whatever comes, where is the fury of an oppressor? Yeah, you can make life very, very difficult initially, but not in the longer term. Not if we're rooted on the creator of all things. "The captive exile hastens that he may be loosed and that he should not die." You look at Joseph, and that's what he was saying. He was saying, "Remember me. When you've restored to Pharaoh's, make sure that you mention him to me, mention me to him." And yet he forgot him. Because he wasn't, did God orchestrate that to some degree? Because quite frankly, it wasn't for some fellow prisoner to release Joseph. God himself released Joseph. God himself made sure of that. "The captive exile hastens that he may be loosed, and that he should not die in the pit, that his bread should not fail. But I am the Eternal, your God, that divides the sea, whose wave roared. The Eternal of hosts is his name. And I have put my words in your mouth, and I have covered you with a shadow of my hand, that I may plant the heavens, lay the foundations of the earth, and say to Zion, you are my people." His perspective is so much, it is a huge one. His perspective is so much greater than ours. As he said to Abraham, he says, your progeny are going to be captives in a foreign land for so many years, for 400 years. And he could see what was actually coming. And yet Joseph had to come to understand that. Joseph had to come to realize that his wilderness years, the wilderness years, and it was years, it wasn't just a quick stay in prison. It was best part of a decade, if it wasn't a full decade. It was that kind of order. 10 years in prison in those kind of conditions, when his feet were hurt, were injured perhaps, and probably made some kind of cripple. And he didn't just survive it. He recognized that it was God's hand in it. And we're not just surviving the time that we're in now. We can go back and we can see the examples of the ancestors that we have as far as spiritual ancestry is concerned. Okay, let's go back to Exodus chapter 2. But in Exodus chapter 2, in verse 10, and the child grew, and she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. Now just think about that, talking about Moses now, and you know, to be able to go ahead and be discovered by the daughter of the king, and then also have his mother come and breastfeed him, and be paid for the service as well, so... That Pharaoh's daughter, verse 9, said to her, take this child away and nurse it for me, and I will give you your wages. And the woman took the child and nursed it. And the child grew, and she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. So he lived in a life of privilege. He was something like Abraham living in Ur of the Chaldees. Well, he lived in Egypt, and he lived a privileged lifestyle. He was the son of the Pharaoh's daughter. He was the son of the princess of the local area. And she called his name Moses, and she said, because I drew him out of the water. And it came to pass in those days when Moses was grown that he went out to, unto his brethren and looked upon their burdens, and he spied an Egyptian smiting a Hebrew, one of his brethren. And he looked this way and that, and he basically killed the man. Now again, Josephus says that Moses became a general, and obviously before this event of killing this Egyptian, he was commissioned officer in the field in the army of Pharaoh, and so as he goes on and says in verse 15, it says, now when Pharaoh heard this thing, he sought to slay Moses, but Moses fled from the face of Pharaoh and dwelt in the land of Midian. And he sat down by a well. Now, so if we look at Acts chapter 7, it gives a bit more information to this event. Turn over to Acts chapter 7. In Acts chapter 7, in verse 22, and Moses was learned in all of the wisdom of the Egyptians, and was mighty in words and in deeds. So he was the son of the princess. He was had a privileged background. He was a general in the army, and he distinguished himself in that position. He lived in wealth and luxury. And yet, as it says here, and when he was a full 40 years old, so he'd grown up, you know, he's 40, he's well matured by this time. When he was a full 40 years old, it came into his heart to visit the brethren and children of Israel, and seeing one of them suffer wrong, he defended him and avenged him that was oppressed, and smote the Egyptian. For he supposed his brethren would have understood how that God by his hand would deliver them, but they understood not. And the next day he showed himself unto them as they strove, and would have set them one again, saying, sirs, your brethren, why do you wrong one to another? And he that did his neighbour wrong thrust him away, saying, who made you a ruler and a judge over us? Will you kill me as you did the Egyptian yesterday? And then fled Moses at this saying, and was a stranger in the land of Midian, where he begat two sons. And when 40 years were expired, there appeared to him in the wilderness of Mount Sinai an angel of the Lord in a flame of fire in a bush. So he was 40 when this occurred, when this incident occurred, that he had to flee for his life and flee to Midian. And when he actually got to Midian, he spent another 40 years looking after sheep. Now, if there's anything that really would humble somebody, and remember, this individual was the son of Pharaoh's daughter. And the indication is that many of these Egyptians were not very fit, and therefore there's a good chance that Pharaoh's daughter couldn't have children. So he was an adopted son. He was her son. He was in a privileged position, a highly privileged position. He was a general in the army, probably put in that position because of his position with the princess, because being the son of a princess. And he became the general in the army. He killed the Egyptian. He was even kept out of the promised land because he had a temper. You know, we know he had a temper. Let's go back to Numbers chapter 20. Just remind ourselves of that. But his temper kept him out of the promised land. His temper presumably killed the Egyptian. And he had to have that mollified. He had to have the edge taken off it. He couldn't go ahead and lead God's people with a furious temper, thinking he was in a privileged position. He had to make sure that, you know, Jesus Christ had to deal with him. He had to get him ready. He had to prepare him. And what did he do? Well, he put him out in the wilderness, and he put him out there keeping sheep. If you're in the wilderness keeping sheep for 40 years, then a change comes over you. Let's put it that way. A change must come over you. And the Moses that went back to Egypt to lead his people out was a different Moses from the one that came out the first time. Very different. And it's the same way with Churchill. You know, the Churchill that left his Conservative Party and then started doing his research for the book was a different Churchill from the one that actually became the Prime Minister. Because that one that came a Prime Minister had a background to him, had been trained, had a depth to him. He was a statesman. He's somebody who would make a state, and he would be able to do that. Well, in the same way, as far as Moses was concerned, the temper that he had to have had the edge taken off it. Even though, as we see here in Numbers chapter 20, it says then, verse 1, and came the children of Israel, even the whole congregation, to the desert of Zin in the first month, and the people abode in Kadesh. And Miriam died there and was buried there. And there was no water for the congregation, and they gathered themselves together against Moses and against Aaron. And the people showed with Moses and spoke, saying, "Would to God that we had died when our brethren died before the Eternal. And why have you brought us up the congregation of the Eternal into this wilderness, that we and our cattle should die here?" You know, bellyaching, you know, whinging Israelites. And they were a bunch of whinging Israelites. "And why have you made us to come out of Egypt to bring us into this evil place? It's not a place of seed or figs or vines or pomegranates, neither is any water to drink." You know, they really laid it on thick. And this was just one of many, many instances. "And Moses and Aaron went from the presence of the assembly into the door of the tabernacle of the congregation. And they fell upon their faces, and the glory of the Eternal appeared unto them. And the Eternal said to Moses, saying, 'Take the rod and gather the assembly together, you and Aaron your brother, and speak to the rock before their eyes. And it will give forth the water, and you shall bring forth them water out of the rock. So shall you give the congregation and their beasts to drink.'" And Moses, but notice what the approach of Moses was. You know, the people just basically bellyached. But Moses' approach was to go to the door of the congregation of the tabernacle and, you know, pray. And quite frankly, that's an example that we should also hold. You know, even having held that, says, Moses took the rod from before the Eternal as he commanded him. And Moses and Aaron gathered the congregation together before the rock, and he said to them, Hear now, you rebels, must we fetch you water out of this rock? And Moses lifted up his hand, and with the rod struck the rock twice, and the water came out abundantly. And the Eternal spoke to Moses and Aaron, Because you had believed me not to sanctify me in the eyes of the children of Israel, therefore you shall not bring this congregation into the land which I have given them. So his temper, his anger, it got the better of him. And that temper had got to be modified. He had spent 40 years modifying it. He had spent 40 years in the wilderness having it, well, modified, having it removed from him, and yet it wasn't removed sufficiently to prevent this particular incident from taking place. So he blew it as far as going into the Promised Land at that time. His next waiting moment, however, will be to go in the Promised Land as a spirit being. But for that particular specific time, it was an example that was necessary. And I think we'll probably... do I go into Israel for 40 years? No, I think we'll leave it at that. We'll pick it up next time and go into the other points on this subject as far as the wilderness years are concerned. And it is certainly interesting when you look at Churchill and what he went through and the way in which he was prepared by God. But it's not just Churchill that was prepared by God. We have our own ancestors that we can go back and look at and see how they were also prepared by God. And we'll do that again a bit more next time.